You're listening to Around Comics, episode 215, brought to you by InStockTrades.com and Devil May Cry by Funimation. Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop on by. We'd love to meet you. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here, and we have a great New Year's panel put together here for you. It was some of our favorite returning guests, even though...
It says it's everybody who returns.
If we like you enough to come back, you are one of our favorite guests.
We're the sequels.
We're the zombies, back from the grave.
The Roman numeral numbers.
Yes, the zombie sequels.
Part and, deux, three,
part,
four,
part herb. We've never had this this group of folks in this configuration though, which is kind of nice. So go ahead and
stack like wood together. This new configuration.
They have ankle and wrist shackles on. It's like a jailbreak movie. So let me go ahead and get everyone introduced. First of all the way from Los Angeles, California, in visiting for the holidays, Mr. Don Glute. Don, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. This is my third time on. I'm feeling like a regular on the show.
It's the fourth time you get your name engraved on the seat.
Oh, great, great.
So next time we'll have a big ceremony.
Unfortunately, he means your seat, so watch it.
Yow!
Rectal nearly killed him.
Next, one of our favorite returning guests, the most knowledgeable guest on the show, Mr. Hilary Barda.
He means drunk. Thank you. Yeah.
He knows his drink.
Knowledgeable of the bottom of the can.
Yeah.
And last but certainly not least, artist and writer extraordinaire, Mr. Tim Seeley.
Good to be here. Good to be here. I had to walk the whole three blocks, which is really difficult.
Yeah. It's Don comes all the way in from Los Angeles, and you guys walk here.
Yeah, and we're both three blocks away.
Really?
In different apartments, obviously.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I don't. You know, when I'm here in Chicago, I'm not that far away, and I went to high school just down the street.
You're making us feel less special by saying
Benedict
that.
High School. That's where I went to school.
So you say Benedict?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I always see the ads. Our strength is in our size.
Yeah. And Doug Mensch, who's a comic book writer, lived on Claremont, just off of Irving Park. So it's all in the neighborhood for us.
See, yeah, this is like a comic book mecca right here
really
on the north side.
We have
side
like
of Chicago.
12 stores here, too, in this area.
It's Tom's been saying it for the last couple months. We have an embarrassment of riches in comic book stores here in Chicago. Well, I tell you what, looking forward to talking with you all. But first, I need to remind everyone that this episode of Around Comics is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. Where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do in fact ship for free. And I believe that you can buy stuff from every one of you guys at In Stock Trades. Yeah, I know that they have the Marvel classic What If. They just released their fifth volume this week, and
you're gonna get a nice big fat check from that, huh?
Well, I think I've gotten all the royalties. I think the Doctor Doom one was the last one that I did for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got paid for that already. But they were nice checks.
Yeah. But they have the classic What Ifs if you want to check out some of Don's stuff there. And Tim, is that / omnibus ever going to get back in print?
Yeah, sometime this month, I think. But yeah, you know, it's I don't. That's not a Marvel book or anything. So this printing is somewhat unreliable. that stuff out. So yeah,
but speaking of Marvel stuff, I'm sure there'll be a new Exiles trade paperback coming out in the near future.
Someday, absolutely.
So look for that, and there's plenty of other stuff out there that that Tim's done. You can actually do a search for Tim Seeley or Don Glut or Hillary Barda, and it will bring up the stuff that you guys have worked on. So I'm sure there's some of the Splash Brannigan stuff that you did with Alan Moore has been collected. So I'm sure that would be there among other things.
Okay, sure. I'll take your word for it.
Well, it's there. You know, just go there and do a check.
It's amazing. So, you won't go away.
So check out those fine folks at In Stock Trades.
The stain of Splash Brannigan cannot be removed.
It cannot. That's a great character. Well, I tell you what, guys. I was thinking about this at work today whenever I was looking forward to who was going to be on the panel tonight. And it was like, you guys obviously have stuff in common in that you've all worked in comics at one time or another. But then I started thinking about it, and this is an interesting collection in that each one of you have worked in comics in really different, kind of overlapping eras. Don kind of came in at the end of the Silver Age and into the Bronze Age, and Hillary kind of at the tail end of the Bronze Age and into the Modern Age, and then Tim obviously has worked primarily in the Modern Age. Well, actually, all in the Modern Age. You're not that
My
old.
Time travel Silver Age book just never didn't come out right. So.
But it got me to thinking about asking you guys what the... not just comic books as an industry, how it's changed, but what the perception of comic books have been and how they've changed over the years. What it was like to be a professional in the comics industry in the 1970s, and then with Hillary in the 90s, and now, and Tim with you as a professional working in comics now, as Hillary does still. We'll start with Don. What was it? What was it like for you breaking into the industry, and how were comics kind of looked at as a profession at that time? When did you feel like I don't know if I want to tell people I work in comics?
No, I never did that at all. I started out writing for Warren back in I think it's 1969. I think it was my
okay. Well, certainly stuff. Silver Age then.
Yeah, and then I went from there to pretty much everywhere. I was primarily writing for Gold Key for a long time, and then I broke into Marvel and DC and all the other companies. Having been a fan, it was fun for me because these were being able to write characters that I grew up with. And, writing Captain America was a great thrill for me. Or even the non-Marvel thing, Tarzan. I grew up reading Jesse Marsh's Tarzan comics, and I loved those as a kid. And there I was writing comics, Tarzan comics with Russ Manning. So those things were kind of a thrill for me to be able to have some control over the lives of the characters I grew up with. That was kind of a kick. And in those days, especially the Marvel books were incredibly in. They're incredibly hip back in the 60s, especially during the period when they were doing those great Fantastic Four books with when Kirby and Lee really took off, when Black Bolt was first introduced and all those are
Surfer,
Silver books, Surfer. Yeah. Those were a great time to be reading comics, and let alone to be in them. I wasn't writing Marvel yet that early. I came in a little bit later. Mm-hmm. I started with Marvel in the 70s.
Marvel, I know, kind of ingrained itself into the pop culture of the time, and even probably more so the counterculture. Whenever you have Doctor Strange on the cover of Pink Floyd albums, and I think the Hulk was and Spider-Man, they were both very much counterculture figures.
And I like the people that were working in the business then. We all kind of hung out together at the conventions, or if we came to visit each other. If I'd go to New York, or Jerry Conway or somebody would come to California, and we became good friends and party together and that sort of thing. So I don't know how it is now because I'm not in comics now, but that's how it was back then. It was almost like the people who were writing them and editing them and drawing them were part of their own little Justice Leagues and Avengers groups, and it was a great time to be in it.
Well, hear stories.
Now everybody just does podcasts.
That's
really amazing. Is that what sitting in a little around the country and just talking to microphones?
That's what they did in that movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The podcast. Remember
them showing us? Yes, we are the pod people. Yeah. But, you always hear stories about, in the early years, more than, like Golden Age, of the EC guys and whatnot, that it wasn't really a highly respected industry. There were a lot of guys that, from the viewpoint of people outside of the industry, these were a lot of the folks that couldn't make it in advertising or couldn't
make strips. Comic Strip. We had a group in California called CAPS, which stood for Comic Art Professional Society. Is it still there?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we would meet once a week, I think it was, or once a month. I forgot what it was. And there was always that, you know, that pervading idea that you know, if you weren't doing strips, you were kind of slumming, or you couldn't get into the professional stuff, and that we were like a lower class or something. But I think in the old days, in the 40s, you got to remember, a lot of us became comic book professionals because that's what we grew up on. You know, we were fans. But people like, you know, Bob Kane and Joe Schuster, Jerry Siegel, they weren't fans of comics because there were no comics.
Yeah, they didn't have anyone to follow.
And a lot of them were, you know, they may have been fiction writers or, you know, just artists in general, and they invented the whole thing. So it wasn't like they were, like I had the thrill of writing Captain America. They created Captain America, and there was no Captain America before that. So I think it was
Wasn't like, ooh, Captain America.
Right, right. It was a little bit different. And now in some cases, I think it's like the lunatics are in charge of the asylum, you know, the way they, to me, destroyed so many of these classic characters, which is a whole different topic, which won't get.
But I think at that time, in terms of art, it was comic books were pretty much at the bottom. Then came the strips, and then came the slick magazines.
Right.
So guys would do strips maybe, and then graduate. You know, they'd move, but they were always moving out. You know, the various people who, you know, were heroes in comics couldn't wait to get out of comics. That changed over time when comics got more and more credibility.
Sure. Well, you look, you know, in like the '60s, and two guys I can think of just off the top of my head would be Jim Steranko and Neil Adams. I mean, those were guys that were, you know, incredibly talented, very, you know, visually.
But Steranko did very little comics work when you really get down
there.
But left such a mark of what he did. It's almost like Frazetta in that it didn't do a lot of work, but what he did has kind of left this, you know, indelible mark on the industry.
Steranko essentially took Eisner and did it as superheroes, you know, an adventure. I mean, and brought that sense of storytelling and added his own design to it and dynamism. But yeah, he didn't do a lot of comics. Don's right.
But Steranko did something else that a lot of artists, most artists don't do, most writers don't do, but a few have. He created a persona about himself. You know, the Jim Steranko,
the mascot in the boots
I know Jim very well, and you know he's not exactly the character off camera as he is on.
He's a hulking man at least.
Right. No, he does adopt that, but the publicity.
But he kind of reinvented himself.
Sure,
you know, and I know a few artists that have like publicists and headshots and things.
Yeah,
Bill Stout did that. He's got a publicist and an official headshot, and I think more people are familiar with Bill Stout, the artist, and his artwork.
Yeah, Steranko had almost like an Andy Warhol-esque aura.
And Andy
about
Warhol,
it.
I think if it hadn't been for Andy Warhol making pop art really, you know, something you would see in a gallery, and all the elitist people starting to pick up on the camp thing. Andy Warhol and the Batman TV show are probably responsible, at least indirectly, for a lot of the success of successful artists and writers of that 1960s period.
Kind of growing out. You know, I was joking about Steranko being a huge man. He has such a big persona and a huge legacy. I met him in New York a couple of years ago, and he is a tiny little guy.
It's hard to get out of traps if you're a big guy.
Mr. Miracle.
Well, he does that stuff like magic.
John, didn't the Marvels for a period in the late 60s have pop art right on there by the Marvel logo? Didn't they say a pop art comic or something like that?
Pop art production. Then DC had those go-go checks and things.
Right.
Very cool. Well, moving on to Hillary, when was your first professional work in comics? Just so I can get a frame of reference.
You know, I probably won't be able to call up the exact date, but Well, I mean, I started inking when the Defenders was drawn by Don Perlin. I inked a few pages here and there. Actually, they were trying me out on little things. And the Thing was the first comic book that I inked for Marvel. That was John Byrne scripted it, but I can't remember the exact year. Sometime in the 80s, right?
Okay.
somewhere back then.
Yeah, was it thing the 2-in-1 thing or just the regular
just
thing?
Just the thing. It was an ongoing series. Yeah,
okay.
So yeah. There's been a few thing series.
Yeah, yeah.
Ron Wilson was the artist, kind of a Kirby inspired guy.
Okay, so early 80s, and at that point, how was comic booking referred to as you know as or looked at as a career as a profession?
Well, I mean, I don't think there was any kind of.
Suntress is here.
Who let the dog?
Every time Suntress comes here, he tries to pet this dog, and Coco has none of it.
John, leave the bitch alone, will you?
It's like I'm a fugitive, like from
the game. But smell the blood on
you know,
Suntress's hand.
John, actually, he's the one armed man.
Exactly.
It's the salami in his pants. Come on, get out.
I killed Kimball's wife.
All right. Anyway, sorry. Back in the gutter. But I don't think comics had any kind of stigma, you know, working them. Far from it. It was probably considered cool, as Don said. And for me, it was certainly cool. I remember seeing Don's books on the stands, the Gold Key books, the Warren Black and Whites, all that stuff. And, you know, even fanzines. I grew up in Evanston. I was born in Chicago, moved to Evanston. And our local newsstand, the guy was so cool who ordered the books there. He had fanzines. The Rocket Blast comic collector was actually in the on sale in the newsstand. He just saw an ad in the back of a Marvel and said, "Oh, I'll buy this thing and see if it sells." And so I was, without even going to a convention, I learned about fandom that way.
And I'll tell you, thinking back, when I was making my living off writing comic books, when people asked me what I did, like at a party or something, I very proudly said I write comic books.
Yeah,
I don't know how many artists or writers in the 40s would have said something
right.
like that. I did, and I aspired to it. I wanted to. I remember back when my musician days, and I was writing other things, you know, articles for Monster magazines, things like that. And I used to tell people, I would really like to write comics. When they asked me, what would you like to do? And that's what I wanted to do, and I did.
Yeah, you aspired to it. Yeah. And I think it's pretty much been the same ever since. You know, and most everybody now grows up as a fan. You know, that's just the way it is, you know, and that's how you're drawn into it. I'm sure there are still cases of professionals who kind of gravitate towards it after they've done other things. There's plenty of cases now where people write movies first and then write comics. That was their way of breaking into comics.
Sure. I think you find that more with writers than you do
with artists.
I think, you know.
Though some people come from storyboards. I mean, there is that where people do the storyboards first and then get into the comics. There's more crossover, say.
Really?
It's not like you automatically get up and out of comics and you're gone. People come back. There's still a prestige. You can have you can come back and they'll promote you as the guy who made that movie or whatever, and it'll.
But having worked with on television, animation shows and movies where storyboards are involved, I have found that the people who started off doing comics turned out to be much better storyboard artists. They've been trained to think visually and not just talking heads.
Tell things sequentially. You know, I asked John Byrne. We interviewed him a couple of years ago, and in a roundabout question, basically asked him if he had ever considered going to Hollywood and becoming a storyboard artist. You know, if it was more lucrative, that kind of stuff. And he's like, you know, what I do, not storyboards. And he had very much this opinion that he probably could do storyboards if he tried to, but his what he did as a cartoonist was so different than storyboards.
And they are, and a lot of people don't understand that. They think that when you look at a comic book, you're looking at visually a storyboard for a movie that doesn't exist yet or may never get made.
And that could be the case.
But in comics, you can go from a panel of a guy talking close up to a wide shot of the exterior of the building with the dialogue. You can't do that in a movie.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta keep within a certain geography there. You know, you can't go from a really long shot to a sudden close-up. It would jar you out of your seat.
Yeah, there are things that you can do in comics.
And there's screen directions. I worked with a storyboard artist. I won't mention his name because he's a very revered artist. But he was getting his screen directions and his camera angles, which looked great as a comic, but they didn't work as a movie.
Now, how about you, Mr. Seeley, the whippersnapper out of the group?
Yeah, I haven't been the whippersnapper in so long, I kind of forgot. That's like... I don't know, man, because I think by the time I came into it, you would say, people ask you what you do, and you'd say, I draw comics, and they'd say, they still make comics?
Yeah. I was afraid you were going to say that.
And it's not a criticism necessarily, and no one ever says, well, that's dumb, but I There's at least until, well, when I first started, it was like kind of just after like the X-Men movie just come out, you know, the first one. And then you started seeing people like, oh, yeah, they still make comics. And now, of course, today, you know, with all the movies and stuff, people are at least aware that comics exist. But definitely when I started, it was, you know, it was mostly just a sort of like surprise that that still went on. Like, where would you even buy one of those things? I think, I mean, it's definitely changed now. I don't know if it's for the better.
Did they ever ask you, don't computers do that? Yeah. People ask me that question all the time. I'm like, yeah. I just program them. You know? It's like,
yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I work with computers.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, you know, kind of getting back to the whole perception of comics and how they've changed over the years. I think with now, there's such this close connection between comics and movies. And I don't know how much longer that's going to to be the case.
Well, I just have a weird thing, too, because, I mean, just with doing Hack Slash, obviously, is like an indie book, so it doesn't sell a fraction of what you were, you know, the numbers you were selling when you were writing comics. I mean, my Hack Slash book sells like 2% of that. But then I get mail, and it seems like the only time I get mail is from people in Hollywood. You know, like, I got an email from, like, a producer guy last week whose work I'm completely familiar with, and, you know, but I don't get mail from, like, just people off the street writing them. But I don't think anyone reads, like, those comics except for people looking for properties to make end up movies.
It is kind of scary. I feel like that. Well, in San Diego at the convention, just everybody's walking around with their comic to sell to a producer. And there are producers who are walking around going to the various comic companies looking for properties to buy. And there's this weird thing that I'd never seen before. I had been away for a few years. And it was the last couple of years.
It is really very odd. I mean, I guess, if there isn't an audience to sort of buy that stuff now versus when you started out, which I'm sure the lowest selling comics at that time is like 300,000.
Back in the 40s, you'd be selling in the millions.
Millions.
But now, like, you can do an indie book and, I mean, you're not going to make much money off it, but you can get it out at 3,000 comics.
Yeah, well, those were the days of returnable comics.
Right,
sold
totally
on newsstands.
Different game,
the black, you know, the black and white boom created the comic book store market where they would do the non-returnable. It's a totally different thing. You can survive on selling 5,000 copies now.
Yeah, but and it's a weird, that's like the size of the market for, like, poetry books, you know? Yeah. But there's a more of a prestige to it than that because, I mean, the people who are, like, these producers and movie guys, they're certainly nice to me, and if I was doing a poetry book, I'm sure they wouldn't give a shit about me. So you can get a certain amount of, I mean, they at least respect comics in a weird way. But I mean, I just wish I had the readership that, I mean, you know, it would be great to have. Yeah, 400,000 people.
It's kind of weird. There is this level of respect with the medium now. Maybe not fandom. Maybe not the people that really love the comics and, you know, the people that come into the shop every week. You know. Geeks like me.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny in that it's kind of almost lost that kind of it's mine and it's only mine kind of feel to it.
Well, there's this weird thing that happened when comics didn't have respect necessarily. They were sort of throwaway pop culture trash, which is, you know, fine, but they were sold like crazy. And now that they are somewhat respected, they don't sell as much. So it's this weird sort of thing, like we gained integrity, but we lost readership. You know,
I don't know if respect and integrity are the right words for attention from Hollywood. But
you can win. You can now be on, like, you know, Entertainment Weekly's list of 100 great American novels, be a comic book. I mean, that would not have happened in the 40s. Never.
Right.
But I think it's just the interest has shifted. Yeah. The people still love superheroes and that kind of fantasy adventure, you know, except in the old days, the only way you could get that was in a comic book.
Sure.
And now, the movies can do it better. They can do more spectacular special effects and can be drawn. They give you the sound effects and everything, do it in 3D and all these other things. And so the people have just shifted their, you know, the medium has shifted that they focus on. It's not the book anymore. It's the movie.
Well, you can pay your $10 and you can go and sit down and, you know, sit back in your seat and be dazzled.
In the superhero movie, which, you know, when I was a kid, what did we have? We had the Superman television show. If you were lucky, you could rent an Old Republic serial, and that was about it. Then you had Batman in the 60s. But now, It's mainstream. Mainstream Spider-Man movies and these are all mainstream movies. And when I was a kid, you were lucky, you know, to get a halfway passable B movie on a Saturday afternoon that the audience wouldn't laugh at too much, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm writing an article right now, kind of talking about how I started reading comics. And when I was 11, 12 years old, I would come home from school every day, and at 5:30 on the local PBS station in Southern Illinois, Doctor Who came on, and I watched Doctor Who every night after school. And you know, this is at a time that, you know, this would have been 1985, 86. It's like, hey, you know what, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back had come out, so I mean, we were seeing big budget special effects on the big screen, but you know, on the small screen on TV, it wasn't there yet. And now we're talking like, you know, mid to late 70s BBC quality special effects.
Cardboard robots. And
yeah,
stuff.
What terrible. Yeah. But I tell you what, to the 12-year-old that I was, there was nothing more fantastical than what I was seeing in Doctor Who. And then it was the Doctor Who comics, the ones that, you know, looking at the old Dave Gibbons stuff that is now being reprinted was so good. So it's, while there's that, the big and bang and awesome, you know, million-dollar special effects movies, I still think for, you know, I hope for a lot of kids that just the seed of the idea is enough, and that, you know, hopefully kids have enough imagination in their mind to fill in the gaps and realize how spectacular things can be without having like these huge budgets. I still go back and watch the old Doctor Who stuff, and
it's a lot of heart and soul. I mean, that's and a lot of times you lose that in those big films that, you know, have these amazing special effects, that the heart is just out of it. It's just like a dead soulless.
It's just an assault of the senses, you know. Every shot is a half second long, accompanied by a loud noise, and you can't understand what anybody's saying because they speak so quick and they whisper it, and there's a big boom in the background at the same time they're whispering this, and you don't know what the plot is, you know. and sort of the same way, when I was a kid, I was a huge Superman fan, but I didn't learn how to read till I was 7 years old, when I was in second grade. 7 years old is when I learned how to read. So a little bit before that, I saw the comics and I could see the pictures. But my main exposure to Superman, going back to at least the age of three, and I have memories of this, was the Superman radio show. So I grew up first on, I had like about 3 or 4 years of the Superman radio show, I think, before I even saw a Superman comic book, let alone read one. And so that's what made the...
It was the Superman Telegraph.
The Superman smoke signal and the cave paintings. Remember the cave paintings?
People talk about Frank Miller as a genius.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak of him as the graphic artist, probably, you know, or the graphic novelist or whatever. Yeah. But
no,
really, they know him as the director.
Sure.
No.
Though, I'm really surprised that, you know, you like read some critical reviews of Spirit, which none are good, but but they still will mention that, you know, his comic work was better, or, you know, if you want to check out Will Eisner's comic instead of this.
Yeah.
It's mentioned. I mean, you know, that really surprised me, actually. I was like,
see, that's
wow,
the, that's,
plug for
that's,
Will Eisner.
What's interesting? Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's the problem with the Spirit. And I mean, the Spirit, awesome. It's never a comic that I'm going to hand a first-time comic book reader.
Yeah, no, it's academic level. But, you know, the thing was, it was introductory level back in the day. I mean, it was a newspaper strip before anything. And, you know, that's really just think of the readership when he was doing that, talking about strips. And you're talking about millions of people, because in a newspaper, when people actually read newspapers, which they don't, but...
The interesting, you know, obviously we're talking about two different mediums, and people do often talk about them as if they're interchangeable, the way the characters shift from comics to movies or whatever. But I remember talking to Mike Mignola about Hellboy, and he's just like, well, you know, if they made the Hellboy movie, if I made the movie, if they made the comic as the movie, if they really translated it, no one would go see it, because it would be this incredibly quiet, moody thing.
It would be a Gus Van Zandt movie.
Maybe it would be a Jacques Tourneur movie. You know, I mean, it would be something from a different era that would have mood and atmosphere that the comic has, where there are long, long pauses. Just the sight of a dark hallway, it would fill you with dread. Well, there's no time for that in the movies that they make now. That has to be people racing down that hallway and monsters bursting through the wall or whatever every 10 seconds, climax, 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 till the climaxes don't mean anything. And my
climaxes
concern,
always mean
well,
something.
Well, yeah.
I've seen that trailer for Valkyrie. I don't know how many times. The only line of dialogue I ever been able to understand is, "We got to kill Hitler." Everything else is boom, boom, boom. Right. I have no idea what they're talking about, saying in that in that trailer.
Well, Don, you're a filmmaker, and you obviously know that a ton of stuff is getting adapted to film now. Have you ever gone out and read any of the comics that any of these movies are being based on now?
Just I read some Spider-Man's years ago, and Iron Man years ago, and the Hulk years ago.
No, but stuff like History of Violence or Road to Perdition. Non superhero fare.
Good stuff.
I mean,
I might go back. I've never read Watchmen. I might read Watchmen after that movie comes out.
Dude, read it now. Read it before the movie comes out.
Is it bad?
No, I mean, the movie would be good.
It's the greatest comic ever.
But I'm just, I mean, the movie, I have no idea. It looks good. But that comic is really, it really is something to see, but definitely see before the movie. Mm. Just because it's not going to be, what it is as a comic book can't be what it is as a movie. It's so much about the, like you said, it's about the small shots. It's about the, it's about the, and you're not going to be able to do that in the movie. Not
I think the problem with the Watchmen really is the structure. It's so, everything Moore does is really focused on structure. The way the page is structured, the way the chapters are down to every panel. There's just no way you could do that as a movie. It's you don't structure movies.
Which is okay. I mean, we can say that's fine. Whatever.
Yeah, the movie has to be something else. Right. Well, let's just put it this way. It's going to be something else. Yeah. You actually probably could come up with an equivalent. You know, there are ways of structuring film, but they're not going to do that. They're going to treat it more traditionally action-adventure.
But if it turns people... I mean, I think Watchmen is one of those really entry-level things, too, where you could go see that movie and go, that was a lot of fun.
Well,
you might be inspired to turn around by a trick.
That's the brilliance of Watchmen and why I think it will succeed. Where some of Moore's other stuff maybe hasn't. I think first of all, I think it's in the right hands with Zack Snyder. He showed with 300 that he can take a comic book and
he eliminates the context, but makes a fun movie.
But Watchmen, it works so well on the surface level before you get to what else is there that I think it will make a very fun murder mystery for a movie with people running around in tights and blowing things up.
Sure.
I think it's going to work fine. But it will be interesting because what Snyder has done in comics before with like 300, what he did there was took a relatively small story with not a whole lot of subtext that Frank Miller did, and he expanded it to the big screen. Actually added story in where I think the difficulty with Watchmen is pairing back.
It'll be subtractive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but, I mean, that's fine. But, I mean, if that turns people on to... obviously just for the sales of Watchmen already, the trades. I mean, I think you see people, you're going to see a lot of people go, I'm curious to see, what this was based on. And then they're going to, the awesome thing about that book is a textbook version of why comic books are way better than film. I mean, that right there, that book, is the best example I can think of of why what makes comics better.
People have been saying for years the book is better than the movie. Hopefully we'll see
But it'll allow a lot of people who've never maybe read a comic before to be like, holy shit, I didn't know. I expected Garfield. I really expected Garfield. I expected three things. Odie falls off the table and that's it. But it's like, this is a textbook version of how to make storytelling that just works on multiple levels and shows you all these things. The things in that book that are not translatable to film. The fact that you could spend a little bit of time looking at a panel gives you the time to look at the background and get all this sort of context and subtext stuff that's in there. And you can't do that in film, and that's okay. That's good. It'll show.
I mean, you can, but that's not. They don't hold
they're
a shot
gonna,
long
you could
enough.
Maybe do if it was. I'm not an anime fan, even though I do voices for anime movies. But the ones I've seen, at least the older ones, just a lot of slow, where people just talk and have a conversation, which you don't see, like in a Saturday morning cartoon or an American animation film or something. And those slower moments and more thoughtful moments. So maybe if that was done as an anime.
There's obviously other kinds of comics, and other kinds of comics are adapted into films. And for instance, is Ghost World, which is the Dan Clowes book that was made into a film. And that's more human scale. It's not action-adventure. Mm-hmm. They made a lot of changes, and yet the writer of the comic, the creator of the comic, was involved. And it had the integrity and the blessing of the creator, and it really had the same kind of feel. And they both things, different mediums, captured these real kids. You know, they really had the same quality about them, but they were completely different.
That might be the one case where I actually enjoyed the film more than the comic, because the film kind of endeavored to. The seems like the comic is more about sort of the empty spaces and the sort of sad sort of thing, and there's a little bit more character in the film, which is weird. I felt that way about
History of Violence. I thought it was a better film than a comic, and I liked the comic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
History of Violence was a comic. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Cronenberg
is Max Allen Collins.
Max Allen Collins.
No, he's speaking. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Cronenberg movie.
Yeah.
A good comic. Max Allen Collins, really good
who
film.
Wrote
too.
Dick Tracy for years and years.
Yeah. A really good comic also, but yeah, it's a.
Who knew that a writer that good could come from the Eastern Iowa?
Not me.
Don, when you started
talking about Road to Perdition, right? You're talking about History of Violence.
History of Violence. Road to Perdition.
That's a different comic.
That's
a movie.
Okay. But so that's go ahead. Tom Hanks.
See, I thought of that as a Cronenberg movie.
Yeah,
it's David Cronenberg.
Which it is.
I always like David Cronenberg movies. Yeah.
So. It's a good movie, but it's a comic first.
It's I will grab it. It's there it is right there.
So, this is for you podcasters out there listening. We're pointing to one of the shelves here at Dark Tower Comics.
I'll grab it for you in a second. But Don, you started out in your amateur filmmaking, working with a lot of the monsters, you know, Universal Monsters
and that kind
of stuff. But then, and superheroes. And you know, I saw your movies with Spy Smasher and Captain America.
Three Captain America movies.
And so we always sit around as comic fans, go, wow, you know, I'd love to see a movie with this character, or you know, I hope they make a movie with this character. Well, you did that.
I did that.
Was there ever a character that you would have loved to have made a movie of and never got a chance to?
I actually planned the Blue Beetle movie. Golden Age Blue Beetle movie, which I never made. I had a Superman at the Earth's Core movie plan. With where he goes to Pellucidar, and then when I realized how impractical that was, I gave that up. I was going to make a movie of Commando Yank. Remember Commando Yank, or the Fawcett character?
I've seen the title.
And the reason I was going to do Commando Yank was because I was starring myself in these movies, and I was, you know, uptight about wearing tights. So I was trying to find characters that didn't wear tights that were superheroes. Yeah. Commando Yank didn't wear tights. So
that's such a game.
Yeah. So I did the Spirit. I did my own version of the Spirit.
Oh, that's cool.
He didn't wear tights, you know. But I finally did a Superman film where you just saw him for the waist up, the first one.
Well, it's time to get that Spirit film out in DVD before the
it's
other
on,
one.
It's on I Was a Teenage Movie Maker.
I've got that right here.
It's on there. And with commentary tracks, it's got Glenn Strange playing the Frankenstein monster.
Wow.
It's
Glenn Strange.
It's got every character in the world.
Oh, yeah.
It's
badass.
It's called The Adventures of the Spirit. It was a 5-chapter serial.
Mm-hmm.
It had the Spirit, Superman, Rocket Man, the Green Hornet, the Mummy, Frankenstein's Monster, the Shadow.
I bend down to you in geek.
The Wolfman, Captain America.
You
Captain
are
America,
badass.
Captain America is attacked by the Wolfman and turns into a werewolf.
They did that later in the comic, remember?
That's awesome.
Wolfman, Captain America.
Well, they stole it from me.
Werewolf
they did.
By night. Werewolf by Night.
Yeah, wow.
Is this you here on the DVD box?
Yeah, that's
cool.
Me.
This looks very cool.
Yeah,
so it's called I Was a Teenage Movie Maker.
12 hours of stuff. Don't watch it all in one sitting. You'll go blind.
You will go blind.
Wow.
And there's also a book and a soundtrack CD.
Available from Cinema Epic.
Yeah, or you can get it from Amazon.com.
Amazon.com.
Do you know Troma and Lloyd Kaufman and stuff?
I met Lloyd Kaufman a couple times. I don't really know him. You know.
Okay. Because I'm saying that's very interesting.
I want you guys talk movies. Go.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I think, I've seen your Mommy's Kiss and... which one did I also see? I saw
Blood Scarab.
The cave.
Dinosaur Valley.
Dinosaur Valley. Because I grew up as a B movie, big fan. My dad. That was what we would do. We would rent, and he let me watch R rated, movies, or whatever. And
explains a lot.
It does, yeah. But like Seduction Cinema, all that. That's amazing that you those films. I actually wasn't aware that you had done that stuff. I knew. I was primarily interested in being on the show because I was like, that dude wrote for He-Man, and I'm a big fucking He-Man nerd. So, but no, that's really awesome, and it's funny that, you were like the dad I could have had. That's kind of like...
Thanks for not saying granddad.
Oh, not at all.
But no,
we had scary similarities. Because then I was a big Troma fan, and I actually did a Troma comic for them
which is like short stories, trauma stuff. Because I've always been a bigger fan of low budget stuff because it's got more heart. I really care about heart. Obviously, I was defending Tarot, the Witch of the Black Rose.
The Mother's Kiss had a heart. We took it out. You could see it in the hand.
See, well, I've always
I was gonna say they're throbbing and on the floor bouncing around. Yeah,
but I've always had like a you know, to me, like most of the time, you know, studio films and stuff, always sort of they. You can see the investors standing on the sidelines going, no, that won't go with, you know, whatever. And I always
you
had
can
a
can tell
big
who the investor's girlfriend is and who the investor's brother-in-law was who rewrote the script, you know?
Yeah, production values got in the way from the beginning. I mean, MGM could never make the films, the gritty films Warner Brothers made because they had too much money. They threw money at everything.
Yeah.
And so everything looked glossy, even when they were trying to walk down Skid Row.
Yeah, the film noir movies were glossy.
Yeah, and you
the horror pictures were glossy.
Yeah, you couldn't. They couldn't make them. They didn't know how to do it.
So, I mean, and I think that translated eventually. Like, you get these these newer films, and I think, like, some of the best films I've seen in the last 10 years were, you know, like, some of the trauma films. Like, they did this film called Poultrygeist, which is probably one of the greatest movies I've ever seen.
Wait, Poultrygeist?
Yeah, chickens. I actually worked on that film, so if you could see it, I did the designs for the chicken for the fast food restaurant. But in any case, like, so, I mean, I think it's awesome that you're turning around and doing the films after you've been in this sort of... you know, you've done everything a fandom that a geek could want.
Anything to avoid getting a job is what it boils down to.
Then I say props to you, sir, and I salute. Because seriously, that's I mean, that's the dream. I never want to make films. I think I've worked on films before. It seems like the worst thing ever. No offense.
Oh, it's the greatest thing. And once if that's your passion, once that gets in your system, in your blood, it's like a drug. There's just no turning back. You're addicted for life. I couldn't do anything... anything else, you know? Oh, of course, I write these dinosaur books, but I'm thinking of phasing those out, you know?
Just focus on the
movies. I used to try to do too many things. I was spreading myself too thin.
You know, it's interesting. I remember when I, before I really got working professionally, there was the romance about comics. You know, I would read a lot because the fanzines were going, and so I read about the Golden Age, and you would read about the bullpens, and of course, later I realized these were really, you know, just horrible places to work where the people were underpaid.
The
sweatshops.
And
there was a guy the sweatshops. You know, and, you know, and there's this editor screaming at you and tearing the page out of your hand and handing it to someone else, and you never really could do what you wanted and create that personal thing. It always had to be part of the machine. But I romanticized that, I guess.
Like a
and
party.
I think other people romanticized the Golden Age and all that in many ways. And those are the greatest comics. And then they said that about the Silver Age or whatever. But I wonder if they'll say that about today's comics.
It's actually the truth. We're the most free and most sort of independent able now, for sure. I mean, I can do a book for...
Well, you can do a book and publish it yourself, pretty much, yeah. But just I can make a movie.
Or create, do a record album. Right?
Yeah,
sure. Or I can do a book through Image and get, you know, major distribution in comic stores. And I can do it from my apartment by myself, and it's just pure me.
DIY.
Yeah,
you really can do that now.
Yeah, you can get an Amazon just if you have a barcode.
Yeah. Imagine what those, like, just guys trying to distribute movies in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they would actually have to drive in their car from theater to theater, you know, when they didn't work with a major distributor.
Right, drop it on.
There was
advantages to those things, too, obviously, because, you know, I mean, you think about how, you know, films used to be, you could get, like... just a Southern USA distribution. Like, a lot of old horror movies are just shown in the South, and they were like the grindhouse sort of stuff. And there was driving, truck to truck, van to van, driving around, showing on a drive-through screen. You could do that then. You can't do that now. Obviously, you can't get a film to show because all the chains own everything, whatever, et cetera.
No, that's not actually
people,
true.
People do that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
We had our premiere of this new movie, Blood Scarab, at the Music Box.
Independent theater.
Arguably the most prestigious theater in Chicago now.
Sure.
But it's the theater I grew up in as a kid. So that was an extra thrill for me. I just knocked on the door. I was walking down the street, and I knocked on the door. I said, hey, I live in California. We made this movie, and I used to live down the street. You know, the guy just rolled out the red carpet. You know,
that's such an exception.
And also, those guys are movie buffs.
Yeah, that's called four-walling it. You have to rent the theater, you know.
Sure, and then the other, I mean, you know, my hometown in central Wisconsin, if you went to the theater that's owned by, you know, Universal and said, I got this film, they'd be like, get the fuck out. Like,
terms of getting your stuff screened, I mean, I don't know how many theaters are like that. I'm sure there are a few around the country, in big cities especially. But then you have revival houses, film societies, and people get their small films out there. Obviously,
and
film
the internet.
Festivals.
But the reality,
the internet being the
well,
biggest
one. Well, then there's
one.
The internet.
Yeah, exactly.
The reality, you know, if you want to make your hundreds of millions of dollars profit, you got to get a huge theatrical release. But the reality is, when people are spending... $10 or more just to walk in the door, not to mention what parking is like and what buying popcorn. If you take a date or your wife or your family, you could become an investor in the movie for what you pay to go in to see it. Yeah. And you don't want to see a low-budget film. You want to see, Tom Cruise and a million explosions and all these loud noises and things. That's what you want to see. You want your senses to be assaulted. So the independents can't compete with that.
And what you're we saying have to do, people want to be assaulted by Tom Cruise?
Well, some people might. But yeah. The thing is, when you're in the independent world like I am, and you can't compete with them. People say, why don't you make a nice family movie? Yeah. How am I going to compete with Disney? Making a family movie. What the buyers want when you take your film to the film market, like the American Film Market every year in Santa Monica, California, they come and they say, how much nudity, how much gore, how much violence? That's what they want.
Shit that's not mainstream.
And then they'll say,
you have
who's
to make a family movie about cannibals, cannibal family. That's really what you have to do.
And if there's a name they recognize, like some has-been TV star from the 70s or something, their eyes light up,
Sure.
Because they're still a big star in their whatever territory they're from. Right. So you've got to give the audience something that the major studios are not giving them. And that's why you got all these gore films, sexy movies, that sort of thing.
A pretty good. My friend Tiffany Shepard is like a B-movie queen kind of thing. And the stories that she kind of tells about how...
What's your name?
Tiffany Shepard.
I think it's Jules Shepard who I know, who's also a B-movie queen.
But just, it is all about the sort of like, if you're going to go, if you're sitting at home, you're like, I'm bored, I'm going to go to the video store. At that point, everything is equalized. Basically you go to the video store with your $10, you're like, I'm going to rent something. Direct to video, and it's got boobs and blood in it, and you're like, I'm in that kind of mood. You could do that, or you could do, WALL-E. You don't know. It could be either. At that point, everything's equalized, really. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you're like, I'm kind of bored. Boobs and blood would do it. In the movie theater, they're not going to do it.
So the trick is you got to make a low budget. When you're cut off from that major theatrical release, there's a certain amount of money you can't spend beyond if you hope to make your money back. If your movie does successful in all the various venues that it's going to be shown or sold in, and I see a lot of people just shooting themselves in the foot by making movies that are too expensive, maybe just by $100,000 too expensive, and they end up, not being able to make the money back.
I mean, isn't the most successful filmmaker ever Roger Corman? He never lost money in every movie. Right.
One of my role models. Roger Corman is, and plus he's a really smart man besides being talented.
Yeah.
Very, very smart, and a smart businessman, which a lot of creative people aren't, myself included. I don't know anything about business.
Me neither.
But he knows, he's got, use both sides of his brain.
Well, along the lines of what you were talking about before in terms of like the content that these distributors or producers want in the films. I remember one of the documentaries on Corman, one of the young directors working on him would say, you'd show your script to Roger, and it would come back with notes, like on the side of it, on the margins of the script would be, possible frontal nudity here, ? I just love that.
It's got to be by page such as, I forgot what the page
right.
9 or something.
You have to have it in each reel at a certain point.
Yeah. He's got to work down to a formula.
That's awesome.
So, that's interesting, too. Can you apply that to comic books? Can you apply that to independent comic books when you're doing this sort of stuff? I tried to do that with the Troma comic book, which was like, just make a comic that I knew Marvel or DC wouldn't make, which it had, fisting and, whatever.
What was the name of this comic?
It was the...
The Troma one?
Prevents the Troma...
The Troma one. Okay, your Troma
Toxic Avenger,
okay.
Et cetera. But, I tried to do something, but comic fans don't... They want everything taken seriously, so they don't really... They try not to appeal to their basest desires.
See, that might have worked in head shops in the old days. There's different markets even within comics, and there's different markets today. Not everyone wants to buy superheroes. There's obviously people who are going to the bookstores and they're buying the Dan Klaus books.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Chris Ware or somebody. But I don't know about fisting. I mean, I think Kirby did a different kind of fisting. Yeah, iron fists, power fists, all that stuff.
They were
stuff.
Like in your face, but they weren't necessarily up your ass. Yeah, that's the difference.
Yeah. Well, speaking of
in your face, not up your ass. Aptly put, young man.
Right, I nearly killed him.
Well, talking about another medium, and that's it's video games. I need to let everyone know about Devil May Cry, the anime series. It's an anime series based on the video game. The complete series, volume 1, 2, and 3, are now available on DVD. And to Dante, it's more than just a game. Cursed by his half-monstrous, half-human nature, Dante must spend his life fighting the forces of darkness, demons, big ones, sly ones, crafty ones, and sexy ones. Everyone, it sounds like a Don Glute movie. Everyone knows demons come in all shapes and sizes, and somebody's got to send them back to hell. And Dante's all too happy to do it, especially if there's money involved. Check out the action scene clips and trailers at www.funimation.com/Devil May Cry. Devil May Cry, available now on DVD. So there you go. That's an anime based on a video game.
Was it ever a manga?
I don't know.
I don't think it was.
It could have been.
I know the designs are very manga.
You know, everything's so connected. It may have been a manga that created the video game. The video game got big.
It's all done on computers now.
And it's all done on computers. And Hillary.
Or buy computers.
All you gotta do is like type in make me computer. This, and then it comes out. Yeah.
And Hillary is a computer programmer. So, I don't know if you're a video game player, Don,
I played Pong once years ago.
Yeah, I kind of stopped when they were the big machines, that took your quarters.
I played Rock Band with my family over Christmas, but notoriously hate video games.
It's weird now seeing so many video games that are now being adapted to movies, especially the horror ones. You look at Resident Evil.
Movies that were not adapted for video games that make you feel...
Like
you're watching, trapped in a video game. Van Helsing. I felt like I was stuck in a video game.
And I think that's true. I think these modern kind of pace and crazy amount of action and nonstop stuff that you get now really comes from the gaming. And they always say every year, oh, they made such and such in games. It always dwarfs what they make in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I mean, that's a tough business too, you know. But I mean, because I've known people working video games, and I thought comics was cutthroat. It's
rough,
horrible. I mean, it's never something. But I actually like, because I don't like video games. I could never give a shit less. I like Rock Band because it's like karaoke, and I like karaoke. But I just could never give a shit less about video games. But I actually do get excited when like a studio like Wildstorm or somebody will put out a comic video game thing. And people they're interested.
Based on their comic.
Right, it's a story, you know, like this Gears of War, which is...
I was going to say, what was the number one selling comic book of 2008?
I mean, largely I think it's because...
It was Gears of War?
Yeah.
250,000 copies.
I think there you go. 450,000.
Was it? Okay. Okay, so almost, half a million.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's
maybe
awesome.
It may have been like 250 its
no,
first
No, that was
week.
A comic book first then, and then turned... No, it was the other way around. It's a video game that they then turned into a comic book.
But, I mean, that's awesome because I think video games actually, you know, maybe... video games don't have stories quite. You know what I mean? They don't have the ability to spend a lot of time on personalities and whatever background stuff. But you can do that in a comic book pretty easily. That might be a really good way to get more people into comics, too. I mean, I personally don't care about... Mirror's Edge or Gears of War or whatever, but it's awesome that someone else does. That's, I mean, great.
Well, I think that might be the next generation of mm-hmm. Don Glute is the kid that instead of making a movie is going to come up with this great idea and make video games.
Sure.
And I mean, it's all coming together where video games and movies and you know comic books, all this stuff.
Yeah, it's all one thing.
It's really just interconnected.
Fast, endlessly boring, nonstop piece of action.
Yes.
No, seriously, I know I'm moving into the category of older than anybody. But it really is a bone that I chew on too often, perhaps. But to me, it drives me crazy. It's like stories aren't action. Action is an element used in a story.
Sure.
Things happen in these movies, but if you slowed them down and actually watched what was going on or could hear the dialogue, you'd probably realize that nothing worthwhile is happening. But they do blow up.
You hope that... I don't know if this is true, and I mean, I didn't read the stuff nor play the game, but I have a feeling like, you know, when like a Gears of War thing, which is totally obviously like guns and blowing stuff up, and you just play it because you're like, this is awesome and badass, and things blow up.
Yeah.
If
Point
you can
shoot.
Turn that into a comic book, I think that the fans of those video games might find something, you know, really interesting about finding more about the personalities of stuff. And
you hope that it's an entry point, not a destination.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think about that like with, I mean, at the...
It's too late to get me. It's too late to get me as their audience, right?
Well, it's not going to get me either.
I worry about the kids video games ever wanting to read a book that actually takes time to get to the payoff.
You want me to blow your mind and probably make you very angry? Nah. Coming to video game consoles later this year, Watchmen, the video game.
You know, that, there's someone else that might get mad at that. It's
like, yeah,
but
someone over the pond. Yeah, somewhere.
But I mean, what if that turns some kids onto? I'm not usually. Well, no, I usually am the optimist in this shit. So I'm gonna have to.
No,
be optimistic. What if that turns some kids onto like reading Watchmen?
Well,
if you're like, it is so cool when that Rorschach dude punches the dude in the face. Hey, I'm gonna read this comic. Whoa, there's a lot more to this. That would be fantastic, and that's okay. You know, I mean, like, look at real practical.
I think there's the factor also that. I don't know how to explain this. It's like when rock and roll first came in. You know, kids, it was the new thing. It wasn't the music of your father or your grandfather. So they didn't go back listening, say, to big band music or anything like that. Or people that grew up on movies, they don't generally start watching plays or going to operas and things like that. And comic books, I mean, I'm looking at a store here right now. It's a lot of people here. I don't see one kid in the store. Kids, I think, have passed comic books. I think they're in this new world of video games, and comic books is what their parents read or what their grandparents read.
But, I mean, they're also, you see, again, I'm going to be the optimist.
You do see them at the comic book conventions. I mean,
you do
kids.
A lot.
There are kids, and sometimes they're brought there by their parents.
They're just see the chicks in the sexy superhero outfits and things.
Well, sure, that's what I was there for.
Or but, the movie people. Or,
but, yeah. No, there is a sort of, and there's also that connection, too, with, you know, this is this sort of internet generation of kids, but they will like read a webcomic sort of thing because, you know, it's just another piece of content to them. It's not necessarily something different. It's just like, you know, I want to be entertained. So, oh, here's, you know, this and here's, and you can do a web strip and stuff. And you see a lot of that stuff be really pretty popular. You know, Penny Arcade, which is like a sort of video game based thing, is a huge readership.
Oh yeah.
And so you see it like there is, we just have to take advantage of it. And I think, you know, you don't have to be, I don't think anything dies off. I mean, if it's a medium of communication, you know, it's always able to be used.
And I can grumble all I want, but it is what it is, and it's going to be. I mean, people are going to, you know, that market, the way where the readers go, they're going to go there because that's it's just, you know, that's just gravity. That's the way things are happening. It's just, you know, I lament the loss or the loss of interest in things that I love and value.
Always.
And
but you got to roll with it. There will always be people that appreciate the things that you appreciate, no matter how small or how they are. When you find those things, if you like those sort of eerie, small, quiet stories, you do a great story like that, you'll find an audience. It may not be as huge as the audience that likes things about people being shot in the face, but you can still find an audience.
I was talking to somebody on New Year's, and when Punk came out, I was out dancing to Punk, you know, in the 70s, but that's not everybody's form of classical music, right? But for a lot of people, that's what they grew up with. And this guy I was talking to, he was saying, he was talking about the Sex Pistols, like, Anarchist, you know, like, well, they had a great melody. And I'm like going, what? He actually called it melodic. And I said,
they have no melody.
Okay, wait a minute. No, well, it's a tune. There's a melody, but it is not melodic. What I said is, compared to what? And he refused to give me a comparison. He just said, no, it's a melody. I go, you remember the song, you can hum it, but it's not Cole Porter. I mean, what are we talking about here? It's a, you know, it's like,
he's romanticizing something.
Yeah, it is what it is, but everybody, sometimes you do lose perspective, I think. I mean, everything isn't as good as everything else. You can say, yeah, this is different, but it's lost something, you know? Maybe it's found something new. You know, maybe there is this art. I mean, Baz Luhrmann, people love him. I think the guy's mindless. I don't think he has any idea what a story's about. You know, just throwing everything at you 100 miles an hour. I mean, that's not my idea of storytelling, but...
But there were, I mean, just because a guy like that existed, I mean, just because a guy like Marcel Duchamp came on the art scene, didn't mean you couldn't be a classical painter and do some really nice sort of, you know.
Well, right. I mean, your average Hollywood movie has not paid any attention to modern art. I mean, most of them, I mean, some of them are unintentionally postmodern, I suppose. They're whatever. But they're not art. They're the same. They're just selling what people want to buy. Same as comics, right? For the most part.
Absolutely.
Most people aren't artists that are doing this stuff.
No, a lot of them are just technicians.
Yeah.
That was the difference between somebody like, to me, like Ray Harryhausen or Jim Danforth to the entire ILM facility.
Yeah.
Ray Harryhausen and Jim Danforth were artists. ILM is basically technicians. Everything is perfect. Every CGI shot you see is at, but there's no nuance. There's no shot like the Tyrannosaurus and King Kong stopping and scratching his ear and a little misstep here and there. It's all, you look at an explosion or something, and every piece of that explosion is coming at you at the same speed. And, you know, you look at these trailers, and everything is moving at the same rhythm and everything. It's just like, there's no heart there. There's
I think it's interesting.
That's when we all come back.
And it's also interesting about that. Obviously, like King Kong is the classic example. King Kong inspired everybody.
Don't get me started on the new King Kong.
I'm not going to the new King Kong. I'm talking about the original King Kong.
The King Kong, And to me, the new one missed all the things, the story points, and the heart that made the original.
And yet, here was a guy, the reason he wanted to make it, the director of the new King Kong, because he loved the original and he always wanted to make the movie with a budget they couldn't get. He didn't understand.
All he saw was the special effects and how he could make those bigger and better and give you so much that you got bored watching it.
I love the original.
You see the fingerprints on Kong and you still believe it's a character. There's an integrity to it. There is something about the human hand's involvement. To see it, to feel that. Sure. It's not... half my problem just with the visual thing on when you get to the computer-generated movies... is they don't look real. The more they try to look real,
they look more like a cartoon.
They're like dense and gray and blurry. They're blurry. It's not even cartoon. It looks plastic or fake or gray and smeary. There's something about it that doesn't have. They can't capture the feel of light.
I think
they've come close. I mean, I thought Gollum in the War of the Worlds actually came the closest to a character that was interesting.
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings. What did I say?
War of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. Whatever. Lord of the Rings, the Tolkien book. That character was interesting. You were able to follow him, and he was obviously based on a real guy who really could act and do the physical movements. But still, there were tons of things in that movie that looked totally phony.
I fell asleep twice during every one of those.
Oh, the movies are Rings movies. Oh, it's way too long. God, they're too long.
Kind of younger because I was like, I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, but on the other hand, like,
I watched the director cuts that are like 45 minutes and an hour longer than the actual.
I loved the books when I was a kid. I mean, I read the books.
You watched it over like
a few times.
A week or something?
But the movies were. I went to see them all, and I must admit, I don't go to see a lot of stuff that you'd expect me to see. You know, comic book movies. Okay. But I went to see those because I was a big Tolkien fan, and they're too long.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, I think you see the... I mean, I totally agree with you, and I think the best films that you see that utilize... I definitely think CGI stuff has a practical use.
When it's done well, it can be incredible.
When it's mixed with...
Like the Jurassic Park movies, I think they're very well done.
Or if it's mixed with practical effects, like the things that should look real. I mean, like, blood never looks good digital, so we use real blood. But... like some things really, you know.
Sure.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Really. John, you'll agree with me.
Snuff films without real blood just don't work.
There's a lot of horror movies. All the Rob Zombie films, which I actually like a lot of his films.
These pigs
digital blood?
Digital blood. Okay.
It looks terrible.
Oh, okay.
Fake. I mean, just practical special effects.
Yeah, we tried some in Blood Scare, but it didn't work.
Doesn't work. Squibs look great. Use squibs. Don't worry about it, you know. But, I mean, you can see how that applies to other stuff, where it's just like, if things are practical, some things need to look...
Oh, it's a tool.
Like
it's a tool.
Grabbed,
I mean,
right? No,
hey, I grew up well before, you know, in comics, Don and I did, before computer, you know, coloring was there. And when it came in, it was horrible at first. It wasn't because computers were bad. It was because they didn't know how to use them.
Sure,
it's a tool, you know.
And you see a lot of really good computer colors.
And they've gotten better at it, and people now can paint with the computer.
You know what else? Well, this is interesting, too. When we were kids growing up, the stop motion effects or the invisible man type effects, which were all invented like in the silent movie days and carried on right up through the 1960s and 70s, and nobody got tired of them. You could see those same types of effects over and over, movie after movie, and never get tired of them. I got tired of those, you know, we had the multiple cameras going around in
Matrix.
The first Matrix movie. I got tired of that while I was watching.
Well, as soon as
movie.
It becomes a commercial,
tired of morphing before I ever saw it actually done in a movie, just watching it in TV commercials. You know, and that magic is gone.
Well, but I always like to play devil's advocate. You have to realize when things change, there's a reason, and they have to catch. And not old ways are not always better, but you just have to hope that when people find a new toy, that they come back and find the old toys that work
better. It's like synthesizer music in the 80s.
Sure.
Totally overused, and it went you know, went out of style, and people go back to what works. And it's the same thing with visual effects. It's the same thing with computer coloring. It's, you know, in my industry in design, it's Photoshop filters.
Sure, exactly.
That get overused.
When it comes out, but then people return to classic methods because it works best. But they can utilize the new tools to make it slightly better.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You just, you know, I mean, it's just easy to be like, you know, new stuff always sucks, and it often does. But
I have no problem with the printing in comics being better.
Gee, that, there you go.
That's
yeah.
not an, you know, that you can see the work better.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good thing.
That's,
now,
that's
if what you do is take advantage of it by coloring every little pixel of everybody's fingernail so that it has the reflected light from the background on it,
it's overdone.
That's not a good use of the printer.
100%.
Well, if it doesn't help the storytelling, then, you know.
Sure, absolutely.
Again, none of this stuff is about the story. If it's what it's about, it's the story, about the character, about the essence of what it's about. If it's what it's about, it's blurry action and throw everything at you 100, you know. Seconds
but that's
or
where
100,
you see things. That's,
I don't know
things that endure. I mean, you know, for instance, the Harry Potter novels. There goes those are going to endure. Why? They combine a combination of modern and classic techniques of writing novels, and makes something that will endure. It appeals to many. Will endure. I think you know, you'll see a lot of comics today. You know, where they like maybe overdoing with the coloring and all this stuff. Those things may be hot flash in the pan, but in the end they'll look dated. But things that are great will be great in 5 years. I mean, 10 years.
But those things that don't endure still will have influence on what it's built upon.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah.
It's you know, we love the Golden Age comics that we were talking about earlier. You know what? Not always great stories.
No.
You know,
sometimes pretty bad stories.
Yeah.
Sometimes pretty bad.
And the art too.
Yeah.
But the seed, the genesis of it was really good, really solid, and that grew things out
absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely.
And I think with those Golden Age books, too,
I have a piece about
characters, I think a lot of it had to do with not so much, you know, you didn't have to have a winner story every issue, or the artwork was, you know, didn't have to be great. You liked the characters, and if you responded to the characters, you gave them a bad story now and then. You know, you accepted it because you just wanted to see his character.
Sure. Was you were talking about the Golden Age of Blue Beetle. He was whatever he needed to be for those stories. Were they all great stories? No. But, you know, it's...
No, most of them pretty bad, actually.
Okay. Well,
but I discovered the Blue Beetle at a time in my life when there weren't a lot of superhero books out. There was Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. That was pretty much it. And then the World's Finest, you know, with Green and Action and eventually had Green Arrow and the Vigilante and all these characters. So... To me, that was a different kind of, even though he was basically Superman in those days, it was a different character from a different company. That to me was kind of special.
Yeah, it had heart.
Yeah.
It had heart. Well, I'll tell you what, let's get this one wrapped up here. Want to remind people that if they want to contact the show, and we do have some emails coming up in the next episode, you can email us at info@aroundcomics.com. And you can continue this conversation at our forum at aroundcomics.com. And we have a new retooled website, which you can go and check out and join our forum community. We would love to hear from you there. Do have a couple announcements here. First of all, Andy Kuhn, who is the current artist of Fire Breather, and he's worked on various other titles. He did the Mantooth with Matt Fraction, and Andy's done a ton of stuff. He worked on Brett for a while. You know, do you know Andy?
Yes, I know Andy.
Great
guy.
My back teeth are floating. I totally had to do that.
We're talking about Andy Kuhn. You know Mr.
Love Mr. Kuhn.
Well, are you going to go to Martyrs on January
10th? His band 10th? Is playing. The Fugglies.
The Fugglies are going to be in town at Martyrs, which is located at 3855 North Lincoln Avenue. And as this episode comes out, that will be this Saturday. So if you are in the Chicago area, drop by Martyrs, and they're going to be the third band on that night, following another band called The Good, and he encourages all the Around Comics listeners to come out and support the Fugglies.
They're an awesome band. Andy Kuhn is the ugliest rock star ever.
What's the date? What's the date of that show?
January 10th.
Ah, okay.
So it'll be this Saturday.
I'm so for it.
It's go Andy Kuhn and the Fugglies, and we'll play Little Fugglies here.
Got some good music. They're a rocking band.
All right.
All right, there you go. That was the fuck list.
I'll edit that in later.
Thank you for the explanation of how radio works.
All right.
You can do that with a computer?
Yes. No, the computer did it all by itself. I just program it. All right. We, as always, are proud to help support the HERO Initiative. HERO creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, and an avenue back into paying work.
Help me!
It is a chance for all of us to give back something.
Does it include, like, investing in my movies?
It could be.
See how that works? Oh, down right away. Found an angle.
I'll call Jim McLaughlin and see if that's possible.
All right.
It's a chance for all of us to give back something to the people that have given us so much enjoyment. For more information, visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809. You can also donate at the Around Comics homepage. We have a very convenient Hero Initiative PayPal button there. And we wrapped up our end of year Hero Initiative fundraiser, and I want to thank among other people, John Sokol, Tim Cornwall, Benjamin Thielen, Ryan Holiday, and Jeff Peterman. All you folks donated to Hero and sent me confirmation on that, so you'll all be getting wonderful gifts and prizes from Around Comics, including stuff Rich Kozlowski signed editions of
I'll give you some art for that.
Hey, there you go.
Man, I'm all about the Hero Initiative.
The Hero Initiative is great. Mike Norton donated some stuff. We've got.
You guys should have asked me, you pricks.
Oh, we that, man.
It's an all-year. You well-intentioned pricks, you.
It's an all-year around all thing.
Right. You so let me know. I give a shit to the Hero Initiative.
Damn charity-loving pricks.
I'll get in touch with all of those guys. But I tell you what, this is just kind of an ongoing thing. If you give money to the Hero Initiative, just send me an email at chris@aroundcomics.com. I'll send you something. Because it is a charity that is near and dear to my heart, and it really does make a difference to the lives of people that we owe a lot to as comic fans. All right, I also want to thank everyone for the iTunes music reviews. I've got a big list of people to thank from the UK, but we're going to do that next episode because we're running a little long, and I've got to get Hillary out of here. So next week, all of our UK iTunes music reviewers, so do that. It's a great way to help support the show. Check out Tom versus the Flash a couple times a week as Tom walks you through the history of the DC Universe one issue at a time. I'm on 11 o'clock comics once a week. Check out the good folks at iFanboy, all sorts of good content there. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Real quick, Mr. Hillary Barta, for people to find out more about you on the internet or ask you about commissions and all sorts of that kind of fun stuff. Are you taking commissions these days?
Yeah, I have been. Maybe through you would be a good thing.
Okay.
Just pass along any comments or questions or
email me at chris@aroundcomics, and I actually have a commission I want to talk to you about. Woo-hoo! I've been talking to Tim. I've started a whole Golden Age theme.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'll give you a discount for the Neesman discount.
Yeah. Nice. How do you feel about the Jay Garrick Flash, Hillary?
We'll talk. We'll talk off mic.
Off mic. All right. Tim Seeley, for people to find out about you and your various works.
It's www.coltnoble.deviantart.com. My website, timseeley.com, is down because Chris Crank, who is a fellow podcaster, is lazy and hasn't updated my site. Colt Noble actually is my homage to Masters of the Universe. It's a He-Man sex comedy where the kid uses his powers to turn into an adult to get ass.
And turns him into She-Man.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story that I haven't got to yet. But, yeah. So, ColtNoble.deviantArt, just Colt Noble, the word.
He-Man, Masturbators of the Universe.
It's like a subtle, cute sex team comic.
And Hack/Slash coming out monthly from
DDP. Still coming out. And then my last Exiles issue is 18.
Mm-hmm.
So, that comes out next month. I think 17 comes out next week. And
so, write letters to all those Marvel editors.
Yeah, tell the Marvel editors that you want me to on more shit.
Yes.
Say, hey, you and Chris Claremont make a good team. You guys should do another book, like, I don't know, something with Death's Head and Crystar the Crystal Warrior and, I don't know, something fun to draw. I don't care. Whatever. There you go. Tell them that we want
to
see.
You know, I haven't had a chance to tell you tonight, but the new Exile stuff looks great.
Thanks, man.
Really nice job.
Thanks.
Mr. Don Glute, folks, to find you on the internet.
You can find out what I've been doing. Basically, two websites. One is just my name, DonaldFGlute.com. And the other is our production company website, frontlinefilms.com, all one word, plural, on films. And all my movies are available on Amazon. So
there you go. And you've got a great Wikipedia entry that if
I don't know who wrote that. I have no idea.
Who does write those? Someone wrote one on me, and I'm like, someone said, "Hey, Hillary, you're in Wikipedia." I'm like, why? How did that happen?
Yeah. It's weird. Someone does it. You know what? If you here's what you do. Throw this out on the if you wrote those things, let Chris know. We want to know who you are. We just want to talk to you.
Well, it is interesting. We'll think they would put the name there or say if you want to talk to this guy, because often if you're the person written, I would imagine you'd want to meet someone who spent that much time
researching. You know, maybe you
good or bad.
And the most esoteric things I look up, I do a Google search, it comes up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Hey, I found out a lot about
you. Democracy. This is the web democracy.
That battle that you won in World War II, charging that hill, that was awesome. Yeah.
By the way, I did.
The World War I battle was much more interesting.
Hillary again here. I just inked an issue of The Spirit. I'm not sure when it's coming
out.
I think it's Spirit 25.
And another
Allure Amancio, a guy who I don't actually know except via email. So
Fear Agent number 25.
Oh, yeah, the backups I'm writing for Fear Agent are starting to come out again.
The backup called Bugged was really
good. Yeah, I'm drawn by Mark Nelson, really great artist you may know from the original Alien series at Dark Horse, among other things.
Right. I remember those are great.
Yeah, and anyway, Mark did a really beautiful black and white pencil tone job on it.
Great story.
Did that come out this week?
Yeah, last week. It was.
It was sold out.
Great story about Heath Houston as a exterminator.
Yeah,
kind of exterminator ghost hunter almost kind of thing.
Very cool. Lots of bugs. Yeah. Lots of bugs.
Big bugs. So that was awesome. Like to thank everyone for sitting in with us tonight. I want to thank Mark Beatty at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles as always. And more than that, I want to thank everyone out there in podcast land for listening as always. 2008 was a great year. 2009 is going to be even bigger and better.
Even Obama-er.
So really looking forward to the next year of Around Comics. We've got some Windy City Comic Con announcements for you coming up the next couple weeks. So everyone out there,
best Comic Con ever.
Hey, we're trying.
We want to make them twice a year now. I don't know. I'm trying to twist.
Yeah, man, I could take like 3 weeks off when you do that shit.
Yeah, you're trying to kill me. All right, everyone.
Three times a year would be pushing it, maybe, but twice a year is not too much.
Talk to Sal. Sal's the one you got to convince. Okay. All right, everyone, have a fantastic rest of your week and weekend. We'll be back again on Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime, there he goes, Kyle.
Kyle's got that.
Kyle in the peanut gallery had it. We'll be everywhere in
and around
comics.
If I was a girl, I'd play the bass guitar and write my songs about a boy. If I was a girl, I wouldn't be too pretty. If I was a girl, I'd be sharper than a tack. If I was a girl, I wouldn't make my money with my face or on my back. If I was a girl, take crap from anyone. If I was a girl, I'd pin a boy like me against the wall, and I'd be his boss. If I was a girl, I bet I'd be a little nicer to the ones I love. If I was a girl,
views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Sorry, would you quit knocking over the beers?
Him the rowdy.
But one of my favorites is.